Hi, all. These are generally conversations between adults after the children have left the table. The language can be spicy and the subjects can get saucy. So if you're ready, you are listening to The Southern Fork, a podcast that hosts kitchen chats with some of the most interesting people in the culinary South. I'm your host, Stephanie Burt, and I'm always hungry to learn more. Let's dig in. The Southern Fork is supported this week by Ariel Trouche and CharlestonAddress.com. As most of you know, I'm a food writer based in Charleston, South Carolina. And here's what happens to many people when they visit. They start wondering, how can I live here? There is a glow about those just falling in love with the Lowcountry. And although I've been here close to 13 years, I will still often have that glow myself. But navigating the right place to live if you do decide to be here is a toughie. Our waterways provide a natural division of experiences, so living on Sullivan's Island is much different than living out by the plantations in West Ashley, for instance. And with the price of residential real estate here hovering around $225 a square foot, you should choose wisely. Ariel Trouche of CharlestonAddress.com can help you do that. She's lived in Charleston for 30 years and routinely lists some of the most impressive properties in the region. But she also knows how you feel. She's one of those people that fell in love with the Lowcountry while in school here, and she's never left. Oh, and she's also lived in multiple areas too, so she knows neighborhoods and the quirks of each location, including where to get the best eats in every neighborhood. But you should know that from listening to the show, right? Basically, it's simple. Ariel is not only about real estate service and matching the right houses to the right clients, but she is also part of the Carolina One real estate family. She has lots of resources at her fingertips. She has experience, and she has the knowledge you need if you're ready to move. Check her out at CharlestonAddress.com to get started. And let her know I sent ya. Now, who likes collard greens, shrimp, or red rice? Then this is about to make you hungry. Listen to the lilt of this Lowcountry accent. Chef B.J. Dennis is Gullah Geechee, part of the descendants of Central and West Africans who came from different ethnic and social groups. Originally enslaved together on isolated sea and barrier islands from Pender County, North Carolina to St. Johns County, Florida, and for about 30 miles inland, over time, these people developed the Creole Gullah Geechee language as a means of communicating with each other. What you're hearing is that history coming through in every syllable. If you've been to this part of the country, then perhaps you know about the musical traditions, the baskets, and maybe even the paint colors. But did you know about Gullah Geechee cuisine? BJ is on a personal journey to discover his roots through food, and he's inviting us to join him with every plate. You might have seen him on Fine Cooking's Movable Feast, in the New York Times, or at many a special event or food festival. But here, he sits down with me to ponder his past and consider his next steps.
Welcome to the Southern Fork, BJ.
Thank you for having me.
Well, actually, can we go ahead and just explain that this is the second time that I've had you on the show?
It's like 2 years now?
Yeah. Actually, you were like my episode 2 or 3. Like, I had recorded a few, but I was not good, and I couldn't keep our conversation because we recorded outside, yeah. And it was by the shrimp docks and everything else. So, I'm sorry, but it only took 2.5 years to get you back on the books, right?
Yeah, it was a little back and forth for tracking me down, right, or running into me.
You're kind of a hard person to track down. You spend a lot of time on the road these days. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about what's happened in the last 2.5 years.
I've been to Trinidad. I've been to Barbados. I've been to Haiti, which is absolutely my favorite island. I've been back home because I used to live in St. Thomas. Mm-hmm. So I've been back to St. Thomas, actually going back to St. Thomas in 3 weeks. And I've been St. Croix, which I met my friend Chef Digby 2 years ago. And, man, I think that's all.
And has it been cooking or research or both that has taken you there?
Both. So 2 years ago was the first time I took a vacation in probably a decade.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I wouldn't even
we all know how that feels.
Yeah. I went to Trinidad, actually, to trace the Gullah roots of folks who were Gullah people who were living in Trinidad. Mm-hmm. They're called Americans, who actually took the whole rice, you know, the New York Times thing that came out, the whole rice.
Kim Severinsen.
Yeah, Kim Severinsen. Mm-hmm. What's up, Kim?
What's up, Kim?
The whole rice thing that came about really was just not even about me trying to find out something. It's about me, what I do, trying to connect the dots.
Right.
Of my cultural lineage. So people don't know there's a group of Gullah Geechees live in Trinidad for 200 years. Mm-hmm. They're called Americans, short for American.
Mm-hmm.
And the hills of Trinidad, and they were still growing this rice, which was thought to still be grown in the colonial period by the enslaved and free people here in the Low Country. So it's a beautiful thing. Your food kind of taking me to places to connect dots that I've been wanting to connect over the years.
Mm-hmm. Now, those were dots that you didn't always recognize. You started cooking just to cook, right?
Yeah, we want to say I'm old school Charleston, so like 97, 98, I went to college at Charleston, and you know, back then, you know, party didn't stop till like 4 in the morning.
I remember, I heard you tell this story, yeah, it's a good one.
So, you know, I had a little too much fun at CSC in those days, so my parents were like, what the hell, you just did 4 years without money?
Mm-hmm.
So I had to pay rent and had to pay for part of my school, so I went to Trident Tech. Charleston, I love my city to death, but it's very limited career-wise. Most of my childhood friends go off to other cities, and they do very well. They love Charleston, but they can't come back. I stayed. I started working in the kitchens as a busboy and a dishwasher.
Mm-hmm.
Hyman's. People can talk all they want about Hyman's, but that place made you learn how to bust your ass
because
it was busy.
Mm-hmm.
And we had great cooks
and
come
two
out of
stories too. Like two, you had to go up and down those stairs.
Three stories.
Three. I forgot about that top floor.
No, don't remind me about 1 a.m. dragging a trash can down the third floor in the bus when you got to get up and be at lab at 7:30 the next morning. You're still in the restaurant at 2.
Yes.
You know, I don't really talk about that back in the story. A lot of people see where I'm at now, but you know, I worked in kitchens since like 98, and not just as a line cook.
Mm-hmm.
I came from the bottom. Which I think the dishwasher is the most important person in the kitchen that you need to respect.
So many chefs say that. That the kitchen will shut down within 15 minutes if you do not have a dishwasher during service.
I cringe when I see servers throw their dishes into the dish pit area. That was me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, don't look at them as some bottom of the totem pole in the kitchen when they're the most important. So, yeah, so I started working in kitchens. That's how I started from the bottom.
And you said you did it for work, and one day something switched.
You know, I think I would say before I left Charleston in 2004, I was working at Hank's Seafood, Frank McMahon, probably the first chef. I will never forget, it was a Friday night before service. And I was working pantry station, and I remember him was coming by and putting his hand on my shoulder, like it's like 4 o'clock, we getting ready. And he said, I'm gonna make a chef out of you, and kept walking. And I was like, wow. Like, he saw that. And I remember him standing in the corner with his now deceased chef de cuisine, Tom, and pointing at me. And I remember his words, reading his lips, saying, he gets it, he got it. And I remember that so clear as day, because maybe 3 or 4 months later, he didn't know that all of us are moving to the islands, like, randomly.
Mm-hmm.
Three blind cooks. And he stood outside. I remember pulling up to work one day, and he stood outside. And he was like, why didn't you tell me? Like, what you talking about, chef? because he had heard the rumors that I was getting mm-hmm. 2 weeks in. Mm-hmm. You're going to leave. Give me a year with you. Give me a year with you so I can, you know, groom you. I said, Chef, I got to go. You know, I never known anything outside of Charleston.
Yeah, it's like the adventure of your life, right?
I'm not moving to New York. I'm moving out the country.
Right.
So when you asked me when it really clicked, I think it clicked for me when I lived in the Virgin Islands.
Mm-hmm.
It was the first time chefs were cooking their culture food on a level that it's like, okay, you can embrace your culture.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a bigger thing for me, not just food. It was like the culture. They knew about our culture here. And like, I would be kind of, I wouldn't want to animate it with my talk because I didn't want them to think I was trying to sound like a West Indian,
mm-hmm.
even though that's how we Geechies talk.
Mm-hmm.
But I was so surprised when they would talk to me about like, oh, where you from? You from St. Lucia? You from Barbados? Like, no, I'm from Charleston. And they were like, oh, you a Gullah Geechee man. You one of us, y'all related. So that's when it really hit me.
Mm-hmm.
And I always was into history, you know, like the first cookbooks I gravitated to was a West Indian cookbook in Charleston Receipts.
Mm-hmm.
And with Charleston Receipts, every chapter starts off in Gullah.
Yeah, and let's talk about this book for a little bit. Mm-hmm. Because Charleston Receipts is the oldest
cookbook.
It's the oldest community cookbook. Right. It was published in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. It's been through lots of printing. I have one of the original ones. And you know, it's still one that we pull back today. There's a ton of recipes that aren't eaten mm-hmm. today that were eaten just two generations ago, a generation and a half ago.
Mm-hmm.
When you saw those intros, which some people could see those as racist, some people could see those as just folky or something, but you'd maybe not seen like your language written like that. Did you go, oh, that's the way it's spelled? That's the way it looks?
I think
because that was just, I mean, that's all phonetic too.
Yeah, I think for me it was more of like, so y'all do sell our culture, but been telling us for years we shouldn't be talking like this. You couldn't tell my mother or father they were a Gullah Geechee. You couldn't. That was a fight for them, because it was a fight for them to assimilate. You know, my parents come us children of the segregation era,
mm-hmm.
the integration era.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a lot of old school folks, but you say Geechee, that was a sign of ignorance. But then you go and see certain things at the City Market, Charleston Receipts cookbook, and they were talking about how this beautiful language.
Mm-hmm.
So that was little things that kind of made me want to embrace it more,
mm-hmm.
if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. And then we have things like the Penn Center.
The Penn Center in St.
Which has been so instrumental for mm-hmm. keeping this language alive, or at least getting it noticed from people away right. from here.
Right.
So.
Yeah. So, you know, those books kind of already was in me.
Uh-huh.
And like, I always, when I worked in kitchens in Charleston, you know, back in the day, there wasn't no social media. So like,
right.
I would pick up the Thursday paper and see who was hiring. And like, you know, back then it was Anson's, and those are the big time restaurants when I was coming up, and they
right.
still good restaurants. They still here. They're still relevant.
Right.
But I would knock on the back doors of these kitchens. Like, I mean, when Lauder first opened Fig, I was there maybe within 6 months, like
mm-hmm.
trying to get a job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes I said to myself, if they're not hiring, I'm just going to go to their back door and say what you need.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because if you really want to work with great chefs, you're not going to just wait for an ad.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to go to that restaurant.
Right. And say, what can I do?
What can I do?
Right.
And that's what I used to do.
So when I know from when I go into a kitchen, and I've staged a few times over the years, it is about, the reason I get so much out of it being in a kitchen like that is that you watch quietly. You can't explain what you're going to see until
right.
you're in there. And then you're like, oh, like you see something that you didn't know,
mm-hmm.
like was a technique or, you know, a process or a way of storing something or something like that,
right.
that recall something bigger.
Right.
So how is that happening for you now as a chef? Who is coming up watching you?
You know, that is a great question. I get a lot of feedback from folks from around the country
mm-hmm.
who know their roots here. And a lot of young chefs. I was surprised. I got like inbox from a brother from Ohio who's from here. He moved to Ohio, I guess, after high school. And he's cooking. He's like, man, I want to do what you're doing up here. What do I have to do? I said, just start. Mm-hmm. You know, pick up the cookbooks. I mean, the Carolina Rice Kitchen is probably my favorite cookbook mm-hmm. from the Lowcountry. Pick up the cookbooks. I mean, I think, honestly, I want to see more young chefs mm-hmm. embrace the cultural roots. And you're starting to see that wave, especially with black chefs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, hey, I'm not going to worry about fine dining no more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm going to show I can refine my food, like Eduardo in Seattle at mm-hmm. a June Baby. So for me, I want to see more here in Charleston. We have great cooks in these kitchens.
Mm-hmm.
But you also have to be a lover of history. And I've always loved history. And I've always loved everybody's history. And my mother made sure to give me books that told the history of my ancestors, because I couldn't always get that readily in a mainstream
right public book. School. Right.
We don't even talk about Gullah Geechee in public schools in Charleston.
It's crazy.
So
crazy.
That's a whole other story.
Yes. Yes. Okay. So you're hearing a lot of that. You are actually working in a catering kitchen. You are that is your main gig is catering, correct?
Yeah, that I tell people all the time. Like I always say to myself, I look at it through a business lens now. Like when I first started doing my pop-ups, I would always tell people I cater because I knew that pop-ups wasn't going to sustain me.
Right.
You know, and I said I wanted to do something that's going to sustain me and I wanted to be a caterer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I didn't just do pop-ups and say, oh, yeah, hey. And my mind frame at that time wasn't to get into a brick and mortar. I wanted to continue catering.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I did. And that's where we're at now. I mean, I work out of a commissary kitchen downtown,
mm-hmm.
Off Remini.
Mm-hmm.
And actually working with that caterer has been, the guy who runs the catering kitchen has been one of the best things that have ever happened to me because I've learned so much about the business side of the catering business.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that catering is pretty damn lucrative.
It can be. Yes, it can.
I look at some of the things I do and like, wow, if I was lying, because if I was a sous chef or a head chef, that's 50 hours of work. Maybe even 100 hours of work.
Mm-hmm.
And I just got that in one check from 3 days of work.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
It's intense work.
It's intense, yes.
And it is physical. If anybody doesn't, it's already physical in a regular kitchen where everything is set up, but you're going into a home kitchen. Sometimes you're making your kitchen if it's outside. There's a lot of just literal lifting 50 pounds of stuff all the time.
Before and after is always the hardest part.
Yes, after is always the hardest.
The hardest, that's the worst. Man,
I used to bartend as a caterer, and I would be like, why am I doing this? I get paid less bartending for a wedding. Like, I would just do it, like, as a side hustle. I'd have to build my own bar, my own ice wells, basically build it all out with tables.
Mm-hmm.
And I can just waltz into any restaurant and work a shift and make that double that. I'm like, I'm not doing this again.
It's a lot.
So will you teach us, when we're talking about elevating the food,
mm-hmm.
this is the idea. This is a, you know, going back to a cuisine that really has been cooked in homes
mm-hmm.
and then actually elevating that. You're talking about June Baby. Or something that you do. Now, I've eaten your food as often as I can, and which isn't often enough. And it's every time I'm like, damn, this is so good. There is technique. So elevating is all about the technique. So for instance, let's talk about a rice dish since rice is so central to you. Like home cooking versus taking that and elevating it. What are some of the elements that you would see? Like, do you have an example come to mind?
I would say a lot of times when you go out to some of the mom and pop places, you get a bad representation of rice dishes because they're just sitting
mm-hmm.
in a steam well.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just sitting. And all the proteins is just in there and it's drying out.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Like that red rice is pretty, but it doesn't really have much flavor.
Right. And it gets a bad. So, and off the subject real quick, when you got new chefs coming to Charleston and they taste this food that's just been sitting in hot wells, mm-hmm. they get a bad idea.
Right.
To me, you know, if I'm running a line and I don't want to say elevate. That's more, I think, more finesse.
Finesse. Okay, that's a better word.
You know, like, okay, so the red rice, if I'm doing like a perlo dish, I got shrimp, okra, chicken, my rice is going to be pre-cooked. Mm-hmm. And you kind of whipping everything together a la minute.
Mm-hmm.
And you can taste the differences. Then say if that rice was already cooked in the batch and it sat in a steam well for an hour. You know, I think you start to lose those nuanced flavors.
You do. Everything kind of just dulls down. You're right. That's a good thing. So it's just noticing as a chef that flavor that you can have.
Sorry, I'm enjoying your dog. It's because he wants to get in the conversation.
Petunia, do you like to be a part of the conversation? I haven't even told where we're sitting today. We're sitting in my house today. Yes. And Petunia's sitting beside me, and she's wanting to join in to discuss the red rice.
Yeah, she's like, food?
Come here and sit with me. Come on, you can sit.
What you were saying, like, I would say, I think I'm more finesse, you know, I'm very into, one of the things I want to see more of from my mom and pop businesses here in Charleston, and, you know, it's economics also plays a part with this too, but getting us back to farm fresh vegetables, you know, everything doesn't have to come out of a can or the dry lima beans. We love lima beans. Mm-hmm. It's good. But, you know, we have so much more that encompasses Gullah Geechee cuisine, the peas. I mean, the different type of leafy greens that we neglect, you know, these things, and bring these things back into the forefront, because I think a lot of times we get caught up into the soul foodness, soul foodishness of cuisine, well, mac and cheese and fried chicken.
Well, and soul food is a cuisine. Gullah Geechee is another cuisine. Yeah. Southern is a cuisine, but also within Southern cuisine is different Appalachian cuisine, Deep South cuisine, Louisiana cuisine, you know, coastal Georgia cuisine, is all of that different, but then there's overlapping.
Right.
So, but a lot of people, when you're, food is a language. Right. So when you really don't know the language, you're trying to figure out, oh, that's Southern. Oh, that's soul food. Right. Or, and you're catering or playing to a crowd that really doesn't know the language or has forgotten the language. So you're telling us that food, we have a much richer language in each one of these cuisines than we're really giving it credit for.
Yes. Yes. I mean, we've gotten away from so much. I mean, like, I'm seeing lima beans and butter beans, but I don't see, like, the speckled, you know, the speckled peas and the crowder peas and the red peas and all these things, you know, and I'll be honest, like, we're just cracking the surface of things too, because I've been talking with Anson Mills a lot, and we're going to do some stuff together. And, you know, Glenn from Anson Mills said, you know,
Hey Glenn,
what's up, Mr. Roberts? 30% of the crops from the antebellum period up until Jim Crow has been lost. And it was because of Jim Crow that we lost 30%. And I'll give you an example. The Benny seed. We love Benny crackers. We love Benny wafers.
People just say, oh, those are just sesame.
We love to sprinkle it. But there's documents, and I study a lot of West African food, because to me, West Africa held on to a lot of what would have came across here too. And there's things called Benny seed soup. Dr. David Shields sent me an article saying how the Sea Island Gullahs, this is like 1780-something, took the Benny seed and pounded it out and put it into their greens as a substitute for protein.
Oh my goodness, that would be delicious.
But you have to also think about the health value of
right. that. It's like a tahini in a way.
So this is a traditional thing that goes back to West Africa. The Benny seed is a West African sesame seed.
Right.
So when we talk about dishes, there's so much more that I have to find out and learn about too. Because, you know, we see everybody, well, Benny crackers, Benny cookies, or I got Benny seed sprinkled on. I think the only chef in town I've seen may have did something with Benny like that might have been Jason at Fig.
Well, Sean Brock did the salsa
at
Manera, and that is insanely good, by the way. It has a tahini kind of quality to it.
And he also did the brown oyster stew, which is a Charleston Receipts cookbook, which is the ground Benny seed. in the oyster
stew. In the roux. Like that. Mm. So there's a code, and I can tell when you talk about this stuff, we're just cracking that code. Yes. And you're excited. So there's a next step for you, right?
Yeah. I guess more research, documentation, putting it all in the book. And the traveling helps a lot, too.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, we had to realize Charleston also was a stopping point, was the main stopping point for enslaved people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm not talking about, you just came from West Africa.
Mm-hmm.
You could have been enslaved in Jamaica for years.
Right.
And been sent here.
Mm-hmm.
So all that has a part of the cuisine, too, if you think about
it. It's true. And also, too, the richest city in colonial America with an amazing amount of export and import. So right. We have things like Country Captain. We have all kinds of stuff with different spices and pineapple that you wouldn't see even an hour and a half up the road.
No.
They just wouldn't make it.
At all.
Right.
And a lot of dishes that weren't documented, because what you see in the cookbooks was what the housewife of the plantation owners would eat.
Right.
And the main cooks were usually Gullah Geechee people.
Mm-hmm.
But what were we eating in the fields?
Right.
Millet and all these different grains used to be grown here.
Right.
You don't see these in the popular cookbooks.
Right. Because they weren't.
They weren't. But the everyday food of an enslaved and free person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, yes, enslaved. I mean, this enslavement in Charleston was very different than a lot of other places around the country. Here in New Orleans was very different. It was not nice.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you had if it even makes sense to say this, a little more leeway.
Mm-hmm.
Hence the old slave market,
mm-hmm.
which we confuse a lot of times as thinking as a place where the slaves were sold. But no, the old slave market was called that because that's who sold.
It was a farmer's market.
Yeah, and that's what it may sound.
It drives me batty when people say that.
And it may, like, well, how the hell would you want enslaved people selling you stuff? But they had the skills.
Yes.
And people don't want to admit that. These people weren't brainless. Mm-hmm. They were brought here because they were, I mean, Glenn Robinson will tell you point blank, the West Africans, their agrarian culture, which unfortunately was wiped out because of colonization,
mm-hmm.
but for thousands of years, they were ahead of the curve
with
the agrarian ways and agriculture.
Well, an American College of the Building Arts has pulled deep into the African American arts as far as the enslaved folks here who could do intense plaster work, could do blacksmithing, you know, like these houses weren't built by white people. I'm sorry.
There's a document that said that in Charleston, when they did see a white person building something, other white folks would stop in amazement and just look because they weren't used to that.
Right.
So, you know, these are the nuanced conversations that we don't have.
Mm-hmm.
But when it goes back to food, a lot of stuff won't be documented.
Right.
Like, you're going to barely see. You don't see anything with Bene seed except for candies and stuff in Charleston receipts.
Right.
You don't really see. Or the brown oyster stew.
Right.
And that dish is credited to.
I am going to eat this. Yes. I'm going to eat the brown oyster soup.
Post it on your social.
I should. I'm going to eat this winter. Because that sounds perfect for like early December.
I'll bring you the local oyster soup.
Okay.
Already shucked.
I love it. I'd like to shuck some oysters though.
That dish you read on in the book is credited to. It says Mom, maybe Nancy or Mom Sarah. That was always a colloquial word for a woman, an enslaved woman who was cooking in the house.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So when you take something like that, you have to say to yourself, oh, if they were putting the pounded benny into that stew, they were doing it with so much other stuff.
Oh, yeah. Now, I'm going to ask you a question that a lot of people are going to ask when they hear this. There's a lot of history, and this is the question about history.
Mm-hmm.
How does that inform us now? How has history informed your present? I mean, it's obviously ignited your imagination and your creativity, but what is this teaching us?
That we weren't taught a lot of our truths.
That's
right. I mean, honestly,
mm-hmm.
that we weren't taught a lot of our truths. That is so much history that unfortunately we want to try to forget, but we can't forget if we don't know.
And that history is a lot more nuanced.
Yeah, it's a lot more nuanced than
books.
Yeah, or just black and white.
Yeah.
It's very nuanced.
Right, right.
Very, very intricate because it plays a role in all our lives.
Well, and I think intricate is a really good word for your food. Honestly, when I taste your food, it is sneaky.
Because it looks very basic sometimes.
And then you take, there's these levels of flavor. I think often about that coconut rice that you made out at Joseph Field Farms, which I've had a couple times from you since. But it was the first time I was like, I don't know what is happening here. It was, I could not identify all of the things happening. Mm-hmm. It was just this umami, sweet, nutty, toasty kind of side dish that was intricate.
Yeah, it's all about the base. Mm-hmm. It's all about the start. But I think my food, it looks like, I call it complex simplicity.
I like it. I like sneaky better, though.
Yeah, it's very sneaky. Yeah, it is. Because it looks like, you're like, oh, it's just tomatoes and okra. And then you eat it. Mm-hmm. Oh, you got little nuanced things going on
in there. Right, there's stuff happening in there. Well, it's time for these questions. Are you ready for the ending questions?
You're making me a little nervous right now.
Okay.
But I'm ready.
Let's do it. I'm going to get on my little piece of paper here. So, BJ, what are you hungry for?
Knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And culture.
Mm-hmm.
I think those two things, I've always been hungry for knowledge. Mm-hmm. Ever since I was a younger kid, you know, history and culture. I mean, because so much of my culture, you know, I wasn't taught. And, you know, you grew up in it, but you don't know what you're growing up around.
Mm-hmm.
And then you find out so much that's been withheld from you. And so much that if you don't do your own digging, that you won't know. So, and there's nice, there's just so much history and things like that. I'm learning that I can't even sleep.
Mm-hmm.
It's like too much sometimes.
But it's always that next thing. Like, yeah. I realize I'm just starting. I'm sure that felt that way.
Mm-hmm.
I can imagine you in St. Thomas going, what? That moment where you're like, oh my God, I'm home, but I'm in a different country.
It felt so comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
When I travel to a lot of West Indian places, it feels really comfortable to me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Haiti gets a bad rap, you know, but Haiti just resonated with me so much. And we don't even talk about the whole bunch of Haitians who came here after the revolution to Charleston. There's a connection to Haiti, connection to Santo Domingo that we have here too. But yeah, it's
and that's something that we haven't explored so much, the Caribbean connection, and then individually with the different islands. It's just another level.
One of the prominent bakers in the colonial period, Charleston, was from the Dominican Republic. And they came here. And I can't remember the name of the bakery. But I'm gonna find out. I'm gonna ask Dr. Shields and I'll send it to you.
Okay, good.
We have these connections. I mean, mm-hmm. like Country Captain, mm-hmm. these dishes. You know, curry
but there are people that have moved here in the past 20 years that have never even heard of this dish.
What do you think? Red rice. I mean, not what do you think? Shrimp and grits and sheep crab soup.
Right.
And then you not even get good variations of these dishes anyway when you go out to the certain places.
Right, right.
So, mm-hmm. you know, it's funny because I have cooked for people who migrated here and they'd be like, I never liked collard greens, so I tasted yours. I'm like, well, you're usually getting the collard greens that's probably been sitting for how long? Under seasoned.
Mm-hmm.
Either undercooked or overcooked.
Mm-hmm. That's true. I didn't like collard greens until I moved here. Mm-hmm. And then I can't get enough of them. All right. How do you think your cooking defines you? How does it inform your identity or reflect your identity? If it's a language, what is it saying about you?
Gullah. I mean, I don't think no other word I can really say.
Yeah.
Gullah Geechee.
Mm-hmm.
And it's I think it's also says resilience. because as much as, you know, that narrative that people like to play, that all Gullah culture is this going way, we're here. Look around you. You know, we may not totally understand who we are sometimes because you know, I think a lot of times we're just lost in the rat race of trying to survive everyday life. Mm-hmm. But for a lot of us who are kind of have a little more enlightened to what's really going on, mm-hmm. and can see through the darkness, you know, we're here and we're not going nowhere.
It's hiding in plain sight, just like everything else.
Everything else.
Mm-hmm. What keeps you up at night? I'm guessing history and all that knowledge.
Yeah. But you know, also, you know, the battle, the next step, the next level, you know. These days, I go through, I'm like, impatient, or, you know, I don't want to say anxiety, but I get anxious.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm like, this next level.
Right. Am I making the right step, or what is the right step?
You know.
Because you can feel something pulling you.
Yes.
But you got to make sure that you're clear so you can go in that direction. Right. Yeah.
Like being pulled towards getting into this building.
Right.
And now that's the inside. Anxiousness.
Hey, Southern Fork listeners, BJ and I were talking before I started recording about brick and mortar.
Right.
Which is, now he's thinking about, it's time for a building.
It is.
And so where is the right place? What is the right place? You know.
Representation, the accessibility for not only locals, but the tourists also. Because honestly, locals don't want to come downtown no more. Even when I live downtown, I'm like, yo, do I feel like driving around to try to park? I don't want to play a park on the garage right now.
Right.
And I'm like, I stay up at night, like, what's this next step, this next level? Because yes, we are in talks of getting into a space, and it has to make sense.
Yes.
You know? I mean,
and there still has to be freedom in that for you, because part of your journey is traveling and also teaching.
Yeah, which I
teaching by the plate.
Yeah, which I never thought would be
right.
Me mm-hmm. teaching, really, but it's become part of the whole spell. And like, I mean, I'm just happy to share the knowledge that I've been given and that I've learned, and also to get knowledge from others by traveling too.
Mm-hmm.
So. Yeah. So the space has to be able to, and that's one thing, the space will be a place where you can come in and also have that quote unquote intimate kind of time with me and like, mm-hmm. you know, cooking classes and talking about history and culture.
Mm-hmm.
And also your great line of good foods
that will be
there for you.
Okay. Now we always have to end on food because mm-hmm. it is the Southern Fork.
Right.
So last meal. I know it's going to change. Mine used to be country ham and I can't do that anymore. After working at Callie's Biscuits, I don't need to have country ham ever again in my life because I cut so much of it. So
And you're making a great point because I've cut so much okra over the years, and I'll be cutting okra and I'll be like, God damn, I'm like a whole piece, and I'll be like, and then I cook it, and I fall back in love.
So okra would be on that.
Okra, shrimp, and rice. I think the classic will. Some people call that dish Limpin' Susan.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's what I've heard before.
Which was the wife of Hoppin' John.
Oh, yeah. I did not know this.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. How cool is that?
Hoppin' John, Limpin' Susan is okra perlo.
Mm-hmm.
But like that or smothered shrimp or rice. People know smothered shrimp and grits, but us geese, we like that. Or some rice, some dry right rice. Yeah, but we bring back some of the indigenous rices too.
That's true. Well, Carolina Gold is worth the $11 that you pay at the grocery store.
I love you, Glenn, but
it's not going to be the only rice on the market soon.
Right, and we need more farmers.
Yes,
growing rice again.
Yes, we
that
do.
That will drop the price point down.
Absolutely, that is true. Well. If people want to learn more about BJ Dennis and his beautiful cooking all around the country these days, you can go to thesouthernfork.com. I'm going to have links so that until he gets that brick and mortar, you can see if you can get him to cater, but probably he's a little busy these days.
You can book me. You can book me. You just got to let me know. Like, I'll squeeze you in.
And also, too, we'll have images there. A couple of images of him, his food. You will see his name in a lot of writing right now about the South, including mine. I mentioned him in a recent Savoir article I did on bread baking. And it is because at the same time that we're eating, we are all talking.
Right.
And we're all learning. We're all communicating, and we're all in this together.
Yes.
So let's eat some okra and limp and Susan and talk more.
Be happy.
That's right. Thanks a lot, PJ.
Thank you.
Hello. Welcome to Talking with My Mouthful. Man, Mark Maron, this is hard. Mark does this every week on WTF, and I mean, he makes it sound so easy, but it's kind of difficult to talk on the fly here on the mic. But anyway, that could be because I am a little brain dead. I've been really, really busy the past month and a half. It is actually the biggest kind of the fall events in Charleston and also just in the food world, food festival, Savannah Food and Wine Festival is going on right now. Just really, really big for these 2 months in the South. So I've been pulled in a lot of different directions, and I have had a lot of writing happening too. So as a lot of you know, I'm a food writer, first and foremost, in addition to being the host, producer, schlepper, and scheduler for the Southern Fork podcast. And I have definitely been in the weeds, but that doesn't mean that I can't take more assignments, editor. So please, if you're listening, send those assignments on. I can be your last minute ace in the hole there to get that edit out the door. But anyway, I have interviewed some very exciting people, but I can't talk about that just yet because those articles aren't out just yet. In the next week or so, I'm really, really excited because I get to go to 2 awesome events. So most of the time, it is true. I do sit in workout clothes without working out inside my house, half the time inside my closet, which is where I am now in workout clothes, not working out, recording this for you. But occasionally, I leave the house. So might be able to hear Petunia in the background deciding to walk around and clink her little collar so I remember that she's here. But anyway, moving on. Tomorrow, I get to go to the Made in the South Makers Market. I put that in my Condé Nast Traveler hits for the Charleston Now for this month, and I am going to join the fun tomorrow, getting to know lots of new makers or new to me makers in the South at the Garden and Gun offices. I am going to hear chefs such as Vivian Howard speak, and I'm going to enjoy some good food and drink. So excited about that. But I wanted to tell you, next week I will be in Bluffton at Palmetto Bluff and Music to Your Mouth. I'm so excited about this festival, and it takes place on beautiful property, brings a lot of really, really great chefs and makers and producers from around the country to this small place, Bluffton, South Carolina, and I'm going to be able to experience it all. Please, if you haven't followed me yet on Instagram, that's at Southern Fork. You're going to want to do that because I'm going to be taking pictures of oysters, recording podcasts, seeing beautiful Lake Country views, exciting things at the writing desk right now. But I'm just as excited about this podcast because I am working on some big plans for 2019. So if you have suggestions for where I should go, what I should eat, and who I should talk to for 2019, please just send them to either DM or try to DM me on Instagram, or you can send them to Stephanie@thesouthernfork.com. I promise I'll read it. Thank you so much. Happy Friday. Have a great weekend. If you're at Made in the South tomorrow, say hey.
You've been listening to The Southern Fork. I can't wait to bring you more culinary conversations, but in the meantime, I have one question. Are you going to eat all that?